You're listening to a DM podcast.
I knew I'd done some serious damage because of the stars. When my head hit, I got like a starburst. It was like being at a firework display. And it was pretty painful. And I let myself out of the seat and dropped onto my neck.
Center
and all
stations
in
the
Charles Air, 1 on 468,
can you?
Still breathing okay at the moment.
Is it a big property?
That blood pressure is not coming up.
1 on 493, understood, thank you.
Hi, my name is Lana Mitchell from the Royal Flying Doctor Service. This is a podcast about life in the bush, mateship, courage, and the role that the Royal Flying Doctor Service plays in serving rural and remote communities. This is the Flying Doctor Podcast.
My name is Kira Lee Dargan from the Royal Flying Doctor Service, and I'm an Aboriginal woman of the Wiradjuri Nation. This podcast has been recorded on Ngunnawal land and is being broadcast across all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations. We at the Royal Flying Doctor Service want to acknowledge elders, past and present. The RFDS recognises that this is First Peoples land and always will be.
My brother is a diesel engineer, and without question, he's a smart cookie. He seems to be able to fix anything mechanical and get it running well, and I've come to conclude that diesel engineers are a special breed of cat. They keep all the big equipment and machines running, and probably if we didn't have them, most of the world as we know it would grind to a halt. In this podcast episode, I'm chatting to another smart cookie diesel engineer who is now happily retired in Murrimbula, New South Wales. But for many decades, his skills took him to remote locations, both in Australia and overseas. Hello, Barry, and welcome to your wife, Davina.
Hello. Hello.
It's lovely to have you both with me. How is Murrimbula retired life treating you? Is it going well?
Fantastic. The best thing you can do is retire.
Well, how do you spend your days?
Playing golf a couple of times a week. We go to Batonk. There's a group here, Alliance Francaise. And we enjoy that on a Friday. Restaurants, I don't do as much as she'd like me to, but there.
And I volunteer at the local information centre, and I also volunteer with a team at cardiac rehab at Pambula Hospital. I really, really enjoy that. And I volunteer for Park Run. I actually clocked up my 250th volunteer last week.
Wow.
And I normally do the photographs for them because nobody seems to like that volunteer spot. So I seem to have got into that spot and now it apparently is mine.
We even had to buy a good camera, didn't we?
That's fabulous.
Yeah, we had to buy a good camera because I said I can't take all these people running without the sports option on the camera.
Look, that's wonderful. Now, Barry, you're a diesel engineer. How did you end up in that role? Were you a teenager that was always tinkering around with the lawnmower and other machines in the shed?
No, I was a teenager who left school and Dad said, you've got to get a job. I did mess around with bits and pieces. I liked metalwork of any description when I was at school. And it just seemed to drift. The town that I lived in, Colchester, was in the UK, and it had a population of 70,000, 80,000. So there was one or two big factories there, and one of them was a diesel company. And they actually produced the train engines for the high-speed train in the UK and the XPT out of Sydney. And they went to Brisbane and other places. I moved into that. They took on 30 apprentices that year and out of a population, a workforce of 2,500. Unfortunately, a few years later, it was down to 300, 400 people.
Wow.
But so that's how I got into it. I did an apprenticeship as a fitter tester, which meant that I could build an engine. I could also start them up, run them and set them up by tuning.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good. I worked on nights for 13 years, which was not good. You know, we used to work anything up to 15 hours a night.
Wow.
Yeah, but I couldn't take it on days because there was no decisions to make and you were just a body to stand around. And so
You were a lackey, so there was more opportunity at night.
Yeah.
Did your work end up taking you to remote places?
Yes.
Well, not so much then.
No, then it did. There was Plymouth, there was Southampton, there was...
That's very remote.
Not so remote, but okay.
They were in the dockyards, the Navy dockyards.
And, yeah.
So we used to work on Navy ships as well, on the engines. And it was mainly either just building them into the ship as it's being built, mm-hmm. or overhauling them in situ, because you couldn't get them out again to do them up. And it's good. I've been to France... and Greece, doing the same thing in a ship. It was an oil tanker, and I was below the main engine. If you can imagine that, I was only 8 foot off the keel overhauling an oil pump, which was diesel-driven.
Mm.
Anyway, people say, oh, you're going there. Well, we went to Japan as well to do the same thing. And I took my next-door neighbour as a spanner boy, and he'd never flown before. He'd never been out of the country. And when we were going to Greece, and I could only get us on a first class ticket. And so when you leave the UK, it flies into Corfu. From then it goes domestic, mm-hmm. onto Athens. Anyway, Stuart had never done this sort of thing before, and he asked if he could go on the flight deck. This is before all the problems with 9/11, and he was up there about half an hour before we got to Corfu, and he never came back. They sat him down in the seats, and he actually sat there as they came into land, a jumbo.
He must have been thrilled.
Well, when he came off the plane, that was like I'd given him all his Christmas presents in one go.
Yeah, I bet. At what point did you actually arrive in Australia and end up living in Australia?
Before that, I got fed up with doing nights, and a friend of mine was got a job in Zimbabwe working on a mine. So I was talking to him the day before he left in his family, and I said, give me the address. And got the address. 6 months later, we joined him in Zimbabwe.
Wow.
It was, what can I say? I'm speechless for it. It was a real eye-opener. It really was.
It was like stepping back 30 years, wasn't it?
Yep.
And we took three of our sons with us as well. Two of them had to go to boarding school, and so they were in the middle of Africa, off to boarding school. We were told we couldn't see them for 3 weeks, and it was like, no, we can't have that. We were so broke when it came to Christmas. We got no money.
Anyway. I'd never been like it. We paid monthly, and we had to repay loans and all that, and we got $10 left to feed family for a whole month.
Oh, my gosh.
So things were going downhill under Mugabe, so we decided that it was time to get out of here. Our older son had already gone back to the UK, because if he'd stayed, he would have been called up into the army. Mm. And that was no good. Anyway, we went back to the UK, and I couldn't get a job to start off with, so I went working on building sites. The coldest winters were horrible. They were dreadful things. So we decided, I decided, that we go to Australia.
Davina decided.
He wanted to go to a hot country, and yeah. I just said, well, if we're going anywhere, we'll go to Australia, because that's where our daughter, she'd already moved here.
Well, that's a logical progression, isn't it?
Then the house that we'd sold in the UK fell through when we were over in Australia. In 1988 we came over. Yeah, so we were stuck with a house in the UK. So we had to live with our daughter.
We had accommodation for 4 years.
4 years before we could sell the house again, because the market dropped out.
Wow. So once you arrived in Australia, you set about working. I think I understood you described earlier, you were working as a small contractor company offering services.
To start off with, I worked for a company, GEC, and they were based in Sydney. And my brother was the workshop manager. And so I'd already got the job before I came over, which was good. Mm. But we decided after a couple of years that we would start our own business. And it was very hard to start up with. We got a place to rent a workshop, and we built up. I think we went 6 months where we didn't take wages. Mm. But eventually... There was my brother and I, and then we employed somebody to help us, a guy. who was good. We were doing work for the Navy, which was steadily coming in, which was good. And we decided we would also offer our labour, which is how I came to be doing that job. My brother was looked after the workshop, and I went off and supplied my contract labour. Yeah, we did several places. As I said, I'd been to Octeddy, doing the same thing for the same company. They were a big Finnish company, and this was a quite a small office in Sydney. I've travelled around for them a bit, and I've done work for other people as well. Now, they come up to Pratunic zinc mine when it was in its infant stage, but I was working on an engine that was in a paddy field next to it with all the cows, and the temperature was up near the 50s. The cows had come all round me, and the flies were settling on the dung and all that on the not good.
So how did you end up coming to be in a place called Gunpowder? Before we did this interview, I'd never actually heard of Gunpowder before, and so I looked it up, and it's a small mining township that's in Queensland, and it's about 120 kilometres north of Mount Isa. So we'd normally say that Mount Isa is remote, so I would say that this is remote on top of remote.
Oh, it is.
I understand, and I don't know if this is correct, maybe you have some insight into this, but the location is thought to have gotten its name as a consequence of the site clashes that used to exist between white settlers and the local Indigenous people. Gunpowder is essentially a part of this copper-bearing country that stretches north from Mount Isa all the way up to Cloncurry, so it's quite rich in minerals and so forth. And they were mining for a very long time. Now, your company was contracted to go and do a refurbishment of an engine. Is that right?
An engine, yeah. The electrical power that they got on site was not coming in by cables. It was diesel generators that were in containers, and they could be transported where you like, put down, plugged in, and they start producing power. And periodically, like a car engine, they have to be serviced. They have to be stripped, new parts put in, refurbished parts, whatever. And that's what we were doing. There was six of us working on this job.
Were they all from your company?
No, there was one from my company. It was the other guy that came to work with us. And there was four from the bought seller, from the main company.
From the main company that was operating this mine.
Yeah, their engines were there. So they were the product factory. So that's what we did.
Had you ever been to Gunpowder before, Barry?
Oh, no. No.
What did you think of it? Because as an Englishman who has seen everything from Zimbabwe to Liverpool, what did you think of Gunpowder in terms of its landscape and its climate?
Not that good. Very scraggy, and there's not much there. And all I can remember is we drove for about an hour, maybe from the airport at Mount Isa, and most of it was dirt road.
Heavy corrugations?
Heavy corrugations. It was a haulage way for the mine when they were bringing the copper out. They didn't mine it. They actually leached. They poured an acid substance into the ground.
Wow.
And it worked on the copper. So they ended up with sheets about 2 inches thick and the size of a dining table or bigger than that, which was solid copper. And that was what they did. And obviously, it got to be transported out of there. Some mines go underground. Some are open cut. This, they decided, was the best way to get the copper out of here.
So it was leaching. And does that mean that there's large amounts of water and so forth around the
There mine. Is a river there. There is a river. Not a very big river, but there is one.
This story was back in 1997. So just for listeners to know, we're not talking about a contemporary activity. So just to be completely clear. So this was some time ago. Now, you were driving from Mount Isa to Gunpowder. How long was it going to take to rebuild that engine, Barry?
About 3-4 weeks.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
And so did that go eventfully or uneventfully? Like, how did that job go?
That was good. The only reason they finished with my services was because most of the job was done and the other guys could finish it. And we were returning to Sydney, one of their service engineers, the top guy and me, had been pulled out of the job. We weren't needed anymore. We could go work elsewhere. So it had been uneventful. It's just been very hard conditions, because even in June, it's pretty hot up there.
Yeah.
It's not far from the Gulf.
So you're driving back between Gunpowder and Mount Isa. What time of day was it, Barry?
It was 8:30 in the morning on a Sunday morning. Mm. And we're going back. We got a lunchtime flight out of Mount Isa back to Brisbane and then Sydney. Everything was pretty standard, you know, but the driver was there.
So you were in the car. You were a passenger in that seat, in the passenger seat, correct?
I was, yes. And the service engineer was in the back seat. In fact, he was going to sit in the front and he said, no, you can go in there.
Just the three of you?
Yes.
And having spent a month there, you must have known them fairly well. Was it a good camaraderie and a good conversation?
It was great, you know, have a beer at the end of the day. And yeah, no, they were good. I've worked several times with them.
So good friends then, good friends.
Yes, very good. And so Chris said, you know, you go in the front, I'll lay on the back, which he did. Yeah, that was the best thing he could have done, I think. We'd only been driving 15 minutes when the accident happened.
Could you tell me what did happen with that accident? Was it a kangaroo or an emu or something?
No, it was just, it was a Hyundai Hilux, and it was the one with a big wheelbase, high wheelbase, and they're not stable. I've since found out that they got banned in the States for doing the same thing. Anyway, we had no weight, only a case in the back. Everything was top heavy. As you drove along the dirt road, it was all loose, and yes, you expect to slip a little bit. And where the airport or airstrip was, we came up to it and you had to go around in an S to get round it. And that's when his back started to drift. As soon as he started to go one way to the left, it swung round. And what do? You steer into it. But quite often people oversteer, which is what he did, unfortunately. And we were then climbing up out of the S-bend and we flipped. And I don't know, I can't remember whether it was one, two, or three. I know we definitely went over and then it came back and I got squashed in by my seat. The roof came in where we landed on it and caused the damage.
So you ended up upside down.
Yeah.
And how far were you from any kind of civilization?
About 10 Ks, I would say. That was where the mine site and mine houses. We flipped. I was hanging upside down, so was the driver. He got panicky because he thought the engine was, it was still running, but he was panicking because of petrol. But it was a diesel car, so I told him not to worry. He was all right then. And he got out and he got a couple of cuts on him and so forth. And I'm left hanging there and on my belt upside down. And I knew I'd done some serious damage because of the stars. When my head hit, I got like a starburst. It was like being at a firework display.
Right.
And it was pretty painful. And and I let myself out of the seat and dropped onto my neck, which was not really the thing I should have done. I crawled out and Chris and the driver came over and they managed to prop me up against the ute because there was no way I could lay down.
Would you mind just describing for me, what were you experiencing or feeling? Like, how did you know what you'd broken and how?
I didn't know that I'd broken it, to what extent. I knew I'd done something because of the stars, the pain. It was like catching nerves.
Where was the pain that you were experiencing?
Around the neck. Pretty job to tell because I've got a bump up here. The nerves are dead, so I've got a patch there where there's no nerve endings.
On your head, right.
That's the contact point.
Gotcha.
So I propped myself up against, they propped me up against there, and I sat there holding my head so that wouldn't go anywhere. In the meantime, Chris, the one that escaped okay, he crawled out through the windows and he knew he'd got to get back and get the mine rescue team out.
Right.
So he trotted off and he'd only gone a couple of Ks, perhaps not that, of the journey.
Yeah.
And a family car came out of the bush to go back to the mine. and virtually where he was. So they stopped, and he told them what had happened and said they'd only come back because they'd gone down for a picnic down at the river and they'd forgotten the peanut butter jam. And the kids were whining, and they come back to get it. And so they were able to take him to the mine, and they called them out, and they came and supported us.
So does that mean then that you didn't end up sitting there for too long? Because, I mean, that's so fortuitous, isn't it?
It was about 2 hours by the time they got there, I think.
Right.
From where I came from gather. And then they were waiting for the flying doctor to turn up.
Were you this whole time, Barry, just still sitting there holding your head up?
Yes.
Was the pain getting worse, or did you maintain your consciousness? Or
no, the flies were getting worse. Wow. I was sitting there holding my head, and they crawling in your mouth and in your ears and damn things. So we were waiting for the flying doctor to come, which was great in a way because the landing strip, I was looking at it. And you know the program that was on Channel 9, I think it was, many years ago, The Flying Doctors?
Yes, I do. I know that one well.
And where's the plane is coming down over to land? Well, that's what this was. I'm sitting there and the plane comes in over my head.
Oh, wow.
And touches down. So, yeah, that was great. They soon got here. There was the nurse, the flight engineer, and there was the medical doctor who came, which I understand now they don't always come out. So I learned that from one of the podcasts.
Yes, that's right. Often our planes just have a nurse, but if they need to have a doctor in addition to that, it's definitely determined based on that call, that initial triaging.
And it was fantastic because he just happened to be a Mount Isa. He was travelling around all the bases. He was able to jump in and come. When they got to site, he knew exactly what I had done, what it was when he saw everything.
What did he say to you? Do you remember that conversation?
No, he just told me to take it easy. They would get me. He didn't tell me what was wrong. But they had to get a big mattress to put in the back of a ute. And that's how they transferred me from my sitting position to the plane.
Had they put a collar on you?
Yes, they had put a collar on, yeah. Mm. Yeah, which I came to live with for a while.
Had you ever been on a plane of that size before? Because they're not, you know, huge jets.
I've been on a small one when I was doing some work on Great Keppel Island, and the plane that used to fly into there was a small one from Rockhampton. I'm used to tight corners. There's no space to work.
Were you worried at that point? Because, I mean, you'd been sitting there for a couple of hours holding your head in a lot of pain. Were you able to move the rest of your limbs, your fingers and toes and so forth?
Yes. Obviously, they checked that, and I just didn't know I'd got a serious problem.
Were you oblivious to the significance of your injury, or was it something that you were sitting there just mulling over and thinking, oh, this is not good, this is not good?
I was just mulling over, I think. It's difficult to describe what you feel when you're in a situation like that. I knew I couldn't go very far. So I knew there was something drastic. But, So they put me on board the plane and they flew me to Mount Isa, which was 20 minutes or 25 minutes, whatever it was. And they were talking to me all the time. And the doctor came with me into casualty. Mm. And he's telling the people, the nurses and triage, whatever it was, he's got this, do that. Do that, do that. And he was spot on.
Mm.
I got what they called a Jeppesen fracture, which is you take a lifesaver and you hit it with a hammer on a hard surface and it flies open, right?
Yeah.
Well, this is what I'd got.
So that's what happened to your neck.
The bones shifted. And C1, it was in two pieces.
Wow.
C1's the one that holds the head on, which you obviously know, but. And the head weighs a lot, and when it's on a broken bone, that's the nasty bit.
Right.
Mm.
Wow. So, do they have to do surgery, or how do they fix something like that?
They had me overnight in Mount Isa, and then the following day they decided that they would fly me to orthopaedic Townsville. I think in hindsight they'd have been better off if they'd have sent me to Brisbane, but you know that's not I'm not condemning them or anything like that. They were all fantastic. Mm. And so I ended up, the following day, I ended up in Townsville. Yeah, and then Davina turned up.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Davina, when did you first learn that this had all happened?
Well, Barry said to me the day before, you know, I'm flying out tomorrow, and he said we're flying via Brisbane. So he said, when I can't remember whether I was going to meet him from the airport or what, but anyway, he said, I'll ring you from Brisbane and I'll tell you, you know, what time flight we're on and what time I'm due home. We were living just north of Sydney at that time in Mount Cola, and the phone rang, and it was, I don't know, sort of early afternoon time. And I said, oh, hello, is this my call from Brisbane? And this voice said, no, actually, Davina, it's not. He said, this is Chris. And, you know, your heart does a flip. He said, I was with Barry this morning, and he said, we had a car accident. So obviously, you know, is he all right? He said, well, he's okay. He said, but he's done something to his neck. So he's in Mount Isa Hospital. And, you know, they're taking him there, and obviously they've got to do scans and everything to work out what the problem is. So I said, okay, well, you know, keep me informed. And he rang me again and said, he's in Mount Isa. So I managed to ring the hospital, and they were able to hold the phone so that I could talk to him. And he said, oh, you know, I've obviously injured my neck. And at this point, nobody had actually put a name to what had happened. So I managed to talk to him, and I'm saying, you know, can you move your arms? Can you move your legs? You know, oh, well, you can't be that bad then. You know?
Go, Davina. What's your problem? Why aren't you home? You've missed your flight.
I'll see you tomorrow. Anyway, then of course they told me that they were going to fly him to Townsville the next day, and the company that he was contracting to, Wartzilla, the guy that was their manager, he was fantastic, because he said, look, we'll get you on a plane tomorrow. We'll get you straight up to Townsville. So I arrived in the afternoon, went straight to the hospital. And it's horrible, but my very, because Barry said, due to all the painkillers, he obviously couldn't move. He got this collar on, and then he vomited, and it went down inside the collar.
Oh.
The nurse didn't give me, she gave me pethidine, but she didn't give me Maxilon.
Yeah, to counteract,
it. So it just went up like a fountain and back down again.
Oh, and so you were swimming in it.
Yep.
So my arrival on the ward, I bent down to give him a kiss, and it's like, oh, yuck.
It was pretty horrible.
They had said at that time that he had a fractured neck. Now, I know this was totally stupid of me at the time, but to me, a fracture is like a little crack.
Right.
It wasn't broken, it was a little crack. But then, I mean, I spent all the, well, spent all the time I was in Townsville at the hospital, and they were turning him one day. They had this fantastic bed that sort of, they put a bit up and he rolled over, and then the nurse was holding his head, and she said, this is what we do with somebody that's got a broken neck. I remember standing there thinking, broken neck? I thought it was only fractured. Which, as I say, in hindsight, was totally stupid. But the next day, it was like, can he have a shower? So you did say, didn't you, that sitting up was the worst pain, because
they did warn me that when you sit up.
Yeah, because of the weight of your head on the spine. Mm. But we managed to get in the shower and get all that smell away from the collar, and yeah.
Wow. So, wow.
And you were in the hospital 5 days, I think.
Yeah.
And then they said he was okay to be discharged. But what I did then, I rented an apartment in Townsville, because I said to him, you know, we can't be travelling until we've established how you're feeling and how you're going to cope with the journey home. So then every morning I'd say, okay, we had a bath there. So we used to get in the bath. I'd take the collar off. He'd sit and hold his head, and I'd wash the collar and wash it all around his neck and then dry the collar. One morning I put it out on the balcony and thought, that's not a good idea, because the wind might blow it away. And all the time you're sitting in the bath, I'm saying, don't sneeze, don't cough, hold your head.
Oh, my gosh.
What we didn't realise is that it was 1 mil away from taking out the tank, which is what the hangman goes for.
Oh, wow.
So it was pretty close.
And, I mean, really and truly, when I think, I think back now, maybe we should have just been given a bit more detail about, you know, how to care for him and all the rest of it. So then we weren't sure about the journey. So then I hired a car, took him for a drive to see how he coped with that. We didn't cope with that very well, did you? And, yeah, the apartments that we're staying at had a swimming pool. So I said, oh, look, you know, we'll go down there. Well, he couldn't stand for long and he couldn't sit for long without the pressure hurting. So they got a fence there that was like head high. So he put his head between the two bars and rested it on the fence so he could be in the pool and he could just stand there and watch me.
You know, Davina, it's, you know what's interesting, this story, it's often how we just take things for granted. And I'm just thinking about what you're saying. I mean, we take for granted that our head is on top of our shoulders and that we can carry it around. And suddenly when that's not so easy, you suddenly realise how difficult just everyday actions are if you can't hold your head up.
Well, when I had the accident, my eyes took x-rays and all that, and it was 7 mil apart, two paces of C1. When I got back to Sydney, it was 11 mil apart.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we flew back to Sydney, and again, the company were great. They got us first-class seats on the plane, but that didn't stop the vibration, and poor Barry was holding his head, almost crying, because the vibration, he said the runway felt as though it was corrugated.
It felt as if on in a narrow track.
Yeah.
It was that bad.
Yeah. So he was told when we got back to make an appointment to see an orthopaedic surgeon, and we went to see one in Hornsby, and the minute he looked at all the x-rays, he said, this is not my expertise. He said, go and see another specialist down near Royal North Shore Hospital, which we did, and he's a spinal reconstruction surgeon. And, yeah, as soon as we got down there, he was, you know, he knew exactly what needed to be done. Mm. And then he told Barry to go to North Shore Hospital to the physio equipment, and they had a non-surgical halo that they attached to the Philadelphia collar, which meant that his whole head, there was like strips going up and Velcro everywhere. It was red and white. I mean, well, you look more like a crusader, like Richard the Lionheart, you know, always red and white. You just see a cross on the front. It had a plastic part that went down the front of him and the back of him, and that strapped round. And he said, you know, the minute that he got into that, the relief that everything was just held so tight, he couldn't move.
I could lay in bed and I could turn over.
Oh, wow.
That's how good it was.
Mm. Wow. So essentially it was holding everything in place. And
everything.
And very, very securely, so you could move as a whole unit.
Yep.
I presume you couldn't turn your head, but you could
could
move your whole upper torso as a unit and not be in excruciating pain. What does it take to heal a broken neck? Because yours was shattered. It was smashed. Right. It wasn't just a little tiny hairline fracture. It was as you described, like taking a hammer to a lifesaver and going whack.
Well, they can operate. They don't like doing it because they have to go in at the front and take your voice box out.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. That's why they're loath to do that. They'll try and get it stable if it will hold. I was fortunate with the job that I did that I got very strong neck muscles.
Ah.
And that undoubtedly helped.
So is that because as a diesel engineer you're always sticking your neck up and inside of engines and, like, is that why?
Heavy cylinder heads lifted on and, you know, it's a real hard job.
Yeah.
It can be work on little ones, little car ones, but...
So I presume you were in your prime of life. So you fit, I presume, and strong and healthy.
Yeah, 97 was my prime of life then.
Were you in your 30s or 40s? Or
you were 50.
50. Well, that's the prime of life. I'm in my 50s, so I reckon that is absolutely the prime of life.
Well, good on you.
Well, it took about 8 weeks that he was in this actual halo thing.
Yeah.
But he did actually, he actually became a really good cook during that time because I was at work. And the other thing was this neck thing. Again, I used to go in late every morning to work because he'd been sitting in the bath, we'd clean everything up. I'd do all of that before I went to work. And so this took about 8 weeks for the whole halo thing to hold him steady. And then they reduced it down to the Philadelphia collar for another month. Mm. But because, and they said all the cartilage and the muscles in his neck,
right,
it will never knit together, but everything will be, all the muscles and everything in his neck will be holding it in place.
So so today, now, Barry, are you in pain today?
I do get some pain from it, but...
Usually when he's been playing golf.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's right. You know, you exert, you've got a swing and that's twisting you and doing everything.
Yeah,
as far as diving into swimming pools, I can't do that now. And
So you're just a little bit more cautious with that head of yours and that neck and make sure that you only use them with the utmost caution.
Yeah.
No contact sports.
No contact sports, no.
Barry, this is such an intriguing story. Did it change your perspective on life at all? Because it's such a severe injury. Did it make you more cautious?
No, I don't think so. I just know that it stopped me painting the ceilings of the rooms.
Yeah.
I can't do that now.
Yeah.
That's very difficult. And I have restrictions. I can only go 45 degrees each way.
Right.
Turning circle. But apart from that, no, I don't think so.
You were told by the nurse never to buy any lottery tickets because you'd had all the luck you were ever likely to get.
Oh, there you go. So that's not even worth trying.
The day, the 15th of September, was when my collar was taken off for the last time. And I can't turn anywhere. I'm like that solid.
Mm.
So, and that day was a very, a great day to do that, wasn't it?
Because
our grandson was born that day. Oh. I had my collar off.
Oh, that's great.
So that was lovely, yeah.
That's great. Before we finish off here, Barry, do you have any advice for others that are driving in remote parts of the country? Do you think there was anything that could have been done differently that day back in 1997?
No, because he wasn't driving fast. He was only doing about 50, which, you know, was quite acceptable. I'd have soon told him if I thought that was dangerous, but no. He just oversteered into it, but I've seen people on ice do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
The natural thing is you think got to turn it quick and you go too far.
Yeah, And now you're down in Marimbula practicing your golf swing.
Yeah, and that's not getting any better. The older I get, the worse it gets.
Thank you so much, both of you, for sharing this story with us. It's one of those stories of something that happens in such a remote part of the country. And isn't it fortuitous that that family just happened to be, you know, ducking back into the township of Gunpowder to get some peanut butter? Because if they hadn't, then Chris would have had a long haul back that 10 kilometres all the way to Gunpowder to get that help. And you wouldn't have been sitting there for 2 hours. You might have been sitting there for four.
Yep.
Yeah. And it could have had quite a different outcome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was trying to catch them flies, yes.
Thank you both so much, and I wish you the very best, and thank you for talking to us today.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Word of mouth is always the best promotion for a podcast, so if you enjoy this podcast or a specific story, please share with family and friends. If you haven't already, join our Facebook group called the Flying Doctor Podcast Community. And you can also send feedback, questions or comments to me directly at lana.mitchell@rfds.org.au. Donations to support the Royal Flying Doctor Service can always be made through our website at flyingdoctor.org.au. The Flying Doctor Podcast was presented by me, Lana Mitchell, and senior producer is Mandy Coolan.